All right, everybody, it is time for another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. But before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, everybody, welcome back to another action-packed, high-caliber, rock'em sock'em episode here of the Crypto 101 podcast, where I am your host, Bryce Paul, joined by my notorious compadre, Mr. Pizza Mind Malone. Pete, how we doing over there, buddy?
You're right. It is a rock'em sock'em episode. I'm here. I'm ready to fight. I got my gloves on. Who's my opponent today?
Well, you don't have an opponent. You have somebody to learn from, and you have somebody to kowtow to. Or if anybody doesn't know what kowtow means, it means to bow down. Because, Pete, Who are we joined by today? Who's going to school us?
Let's see. Who's on this list? Oh, my God. We're joined by Lex Sokolin from... Is he the head economist at Consensus?
He is. Lex Sokolin's head economist at Consensus. He works on a whole suite of products. And he is what I like to kind of refer to as the token master or the token genius. Anything that has to do with tokens on top of projects. You're like, what is this? Is the governance token? Is this anything like that? We're going to talk to Lex. Lex, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. That's quite an introduction. definitely setting a high bar there. So I'll try to entertain a little bit.
No, we're going to have some fun.
Yeah, while I'm untaping my fists, give us the high level of what is Consensus the company? Because we hear the word Consensus a lot, and we're talking about blockchain agreements and things like that. But there's another company out there with a very similar name. So give us the high level. What is Consensus, and why is this company so important to the crypto industry?
Absolutely. So Consensus is really at the heart of what people call Web3, the next generation of the web that runs on blockchains. And it was founded right around the founding of Ethereum, which is the leading computational blockchain that runs all of this decentralized software. So if you're using an app that requires your crypto wallet to plug into it, you're using a decentralized application, decentralized software. Maybe it's DeFi, maybe it's NFTs, who knows. Anyway, all this stuff runs on these blockchains that can execute contracts. And Consensus came out of the early Ethereum moment, was founded by Joe Lubin, who's also a co-founder of Ethereum. And it really helped stand up the ecosystem very early on, getting hundreds of thousands of developers to build things, getting now 10 million users into MetaMask, the leading crypto wallet for Web3. And so we are at the very center of what right now is kind of a tornado of innovation and disruption and all sorts of wild internet stuff. And I'd say the main thing that we do is help people use blockchain-based software and the economy that comes out of it. And then we help developers, whether they're, you know, somebody trying to learn how to code for the first time, or whether they are JP Morgan, developers trying to build on top of these systems. And so that's at the heart of what we're after.
That's fascinating. And you know, Consensus kind of works on or operates a lot of different products. One of the most, you know, notable ones I think a lot of people have used and kind of, you know, a household name is MetaMask. And I know that you're pretty intertwined with that. But what other products does Consensus have that are pretty popular?
Sure. You know, it's a dangerous question of what's popular in crypto, you know, depending on what Twitter personality you ask.
Or what day or what week it is out of the year.
Yeah, exactly. What side of the moon you're reflected of. But, you know, one of our core projects is called Infura, which is, it's an Ethereum API provider. So if you're a developer and engineer trying to make your next best app, you know, in the old world, you would need AWS to plug into somebody's cloud server. And then in the new world, you want to connect into the Ethereum network itself, but it's quite hard to run that infrastructure. And so Infura helps people build applications and many of the popular decentralized applications in some way use Infura in order to be able to perform. And then we've got stuff like Truffle, which is a library of different code. And we also work with large institutional players because we think end of the day, the economy will melt together between the old world and the new. And so it's important to work with, you know, the MasterCards and the JP Morgans of the world. And so we run enterprise chains in a group called Quorum. You might have heard about that if you're sort of following the distributed ledger world. And so Quorum supports these big institutional wholesale payments networks. It supports some supply chain networks. And so, you know, we're really trying to bring a lot of threads together, central bank digital currency threads all together, so that there's a real economy on Web3 and, you know, people have options and are able to do the types of things that they expect.
Wow, that's fascinating. And you said some big names right there, you know, JP Morgan, MasterCard, I think I heard. So these kind of remind me of a key word that we talk about a lot is institutional adoption, right? Everybody likes that the meme, institutional adoption, the institutions are coming. Well, finally, they've arrived in 2020. So could you kind of paint us a picture just from your vantage point of working with these guys? What does the present look like? And what does kind of the future look like in terms of institutional adoption? Is the wave really coming? Are these guys really starting to, you know, pick up crypto? Or they still lead the way?
I think the nice thing that we've learned is actually while traditional institutional adoption or like incumbent adoption of the stuff is important, it's very much not the main show. It's not the main thing. Like the last couple of years with DeFi and NFTs and now blockchain gaming has really shown that the alpha and the innovation and the stuff that matters is being done in a permissionless global way by entrepreneurs. And I think that's kind of really important. Like we don't need the blessing of the traditional industry in order to build out a completely new economy that is very valuable. You know, and so we've seen this on the MetaMask side with people using the wallet to access all sorts of new applications, whether it's gaming or collecting or trading or lending, you know, pick your favorite one. And that's grown from like 100,000 just a year and a half ago or 2 years ago to 10 million per month now, which is just, you know, insane. And it's from all over the world, right? It's not from just one place. It's literally every single country. And so I think one takeaway is like, we don't need to wait for the past in order to go to the future. We can just continue to build that for ourselves. And I think, you know, when you think about the internet, yes, there was a lot of digital transformation for companies like Disney and Walmart, but there were also internet native companies like Amazon and Google. And so crypto native companies, you know, have a fantastic opportunity ahead of them. Now, the second thing that's going on, of course, is that the incumbents are really trying to think of what to do with all these themes. And it's not straightforward. It's not easy. And I think for the last kind of 3-4 years, one of the thoughts was, how do we save cost with blockchain? You know, how do we implement enterprise blockchain into our capital market stack or supply chain stack or central bank digital currency stack, right? And how do we get efficiencies in running the systems that power our world? And this is naturally slow and difficult because it invokes things that already exist and it can break them. And it also invokes regulation and existing interests. But then there's a second thing that's kind of happening now that's really interesting, which is that it's not just cost, it's also revenue and accessing the asset class. So institutions are realizing that not only can I save some money by having efficient databases, which is a very, very narrow view of what's going on and I think is incorrect, but I can also provide access to the asset class of cryptocurrencies, of tokens, and so on. And I can make that part of client portfolios and that can lead to revenue. And that's a much, much easier story to tell. So, you know, we've got an institutional wrapper for MetaMask so that like crypto funds can plug in and go and do the long tail of DeFi. And we're seeing a lot of interest from traditional hedge funds, you know, large private equity firms. And I mean, in the industry, you can just read the headlines of Apollo and KKR and the Tiger Cubs, all large alternative investors who you would think as institutions moving into the space in order to invest because they believe the space is going to expand very quickly. So I think that's really positive because what it shows is that we're not kind of talking about the technology as this limited tool. We're talking about a new economy that's expanding and is worth investing in.
Yeah, very well said. There's a lot to unpack there. So what I found really, really interesting about what you were talking about is how once upon a time in the very, very, you know, near past, the whole purpose of designing a software product would be to sell it and have a quick exit in a few years. You know, hopefully Apple will buy this, Google will buy this, Facebook will buy this. But you guys and a lot of people in crypto are very rooted and you believe in what you're building and you won't sell for any price. I know MetaMask has received ridiculous offers and you guys have turned them all down. Not that you don't need the money, but you believe in the purpose of MetaMask and keeping this a pure software, not having it injected by ads or trackers or whatever else a new owner might do to it. So you've been not just a developer, but a guardian of these Web3 tools as well. So first off, I have to say thank you for all of that. And it's also really interesting that, you know, a JP Morgan or another large financial firm would want to turn to essentially open source developers that have come together to form a company instead of having their own, you know, private stuff from the inside where they can keep it really, really close to the vest. They're starting to realize the value and not just the value, but the talent that's out there as well in this space. So I think that's a huge shift. You know, we saw in 2017, new crypto companies trying to raise absolutely every dollar they could and giving away their companies for, you know, pretty much the entire equity right away. Where now there's, you know, seed raises from new founders that are only asking for like $100,000 and trying to keep as much of the equity and control as possible to themselves. So I thought that's a really, really interesting shift in this space. And in addition to that, you know, now, and then you're talking later about, you know, just the new concerns and the new tools that these need. So we've got, you know, a new term, let's say, we'll call it RegFi, you know, regulated finance amongst this blockchain Web3 world versus decentralized finance that completely pushes that old guard away. So you've got two schools of thought. One, well, we'll help the old incumbents come along and, you know, meet in the middle. And the other one saying, we're just going to leave the whole old world behind. You know, can these two worlds coexist together, or is one eventually going to eat the other?
Yeah, that's a wonderful fundamental question. And it requires like a philosophical, metaphysical answer, because it's not, you know, it's not an equation. It's not it's not black or white. And I think if we look at, you know, one of the best things we can do is reason by kind of analogy, right? So yes, we're in a pretty novel place, and the patterns that are being designed are pretty orthogonal, meaning like they're contradictory to some of the prior ways of doing things, but it's not like orthogonal things didn't happen before, right? Like we're not using video cassettes anymore, and the people still consuming media. And so even if we aren't using particular banking or payment rails, no matter how many magic sort of Merlin words you put on top of it, payments are still payments. You know, no matter how many wizards you put on top of lending, it's still lending, and it's still a loan with some underwriting underneath it. So I think there are some underlying human patterns that map onto DeFi and the types of things that are powered by computational blockchains. And so, you know, we as society are not novices and at understanding how people behave at scale and sort of like the types of behavioral outcomes they generate. Anyway, all that to say that, you know, there's one version of the world where blockchain-based finance is just another lane, you know, separate and distinct from the traditional lanes. But like you get into an Uber and you don't expect to take cash and put it into your phone in order to pay the driver. That would be insane. You'd be a crazy person to be like, why does my phone not take cash? It doesn't take cash because it's incompatible. And how many payment methods are there? Well, there's cash, and then there's electronic payments over the card networks and the rails. And then there is proximity payments with QR codes. And then there are proximity payments with NFC. And then there are ACH payments and there are wires. And then there's payments through PayPal, which is a gateway on top of e-commerce, and so on and so forth. Like, you know, there's 5 to 10 major different train tracks for how money moves. And that's just for how money moves, you know, forget brokerage and lending and insurance and all of that. So the narrow view would say, listen, there's plenty of space for a new set of rails for this type of financial activity, and it'll be successful on its own, and the old stuff will, you know, just continue to exist. But then there's also the more interesting kind of maximalist view, which is that we really are at a place where the internet, Web 2 has a broken model, and where the lack of value in things on the internet, meaning that, you know, all media objects are free and you can just right click and save as, or you can, you know, get all of the world's music on Spotify for $10 a month. Maybe that's not right. Maybe what that does is, because there's no economics in it, you take the attention, you take the labor of consuming an object, and you take that labor and you turn that into a product and you sell that product, you know, and then you get to fairly dystopian outcomes like the ones that we have today, which is nobody's fault. It's just you massively complex system playing out to its extreme and generating really kind of perverse political and social outcomes. Anyway, and so now we've got this additional building block of respecting digital objects, such that, let's say you spend a month making a painting in the real world with paint and on a canvas, and it took you 15 years of art school training to make it beautiful. Now, let's say you spend a month on your computer rendering a beautiful digital object, and it took you 15 years of art school to make it beautiful. There is no reason that's legible. Literally no legible, coherent reason why those two objects, you know, one should be more valuable and the other one should be less valuable. In fact, the one on wood is, you know, embarrassingly out of date and anachronistic. And so why is the modern version of this object not worth anything? It's wrong in terms of kind of economic incentives and the lack of markets. And so you can't buy it, you can't transact against it, and so on. And so blockchain-based economies fix this. They reintroduce scarcity into digital objects, which implies that, like, we can be people again. Like, we can buy things. I can buy your poem and you can write me a song and I can buy that and I can send you some money on the internet, and I don't need to have a locker of my passport and my address with every, you know, pharmacy I go to online that is then hacked and sold somewhere. And so I find this vision extremely compelling. And I do think that we are having a restructuring, not just of like a payment rail for the next version of Uber, but we're having a restructuring for how, like, just people interact, how they transact, what they find valuable, what they think is social status. And all of that is getting crunched up and kind of reordered in large part by, you know, now Gen Z, and it's being done on blockchain rails. And so I think that expansive vision is one that's going to be really challenging to traditional institutions that are not designed on top of a chassis that looks this way, that are designed in a very different manner. I'll give one last example because I know I've been rambling on, but
this is, you know, great. Keep going.
You know, so there's one version in the world where it's very rare for a group of people or a person to issue, let's say, equity, or to issue security, to issue a share, or if you abstract it one level higher, to issue an economic interest in their activity and their success. It's very rare. Like, it's so hard to get signed to a record label. It's really hard to go public. It's even hard to start a partnership, you know, and start a Delaware C Corp or whatever it is. And it only happens every 3 years. And when you do, it's so important. You know, this is how medieval priests felt about writing. Writing was sacred. Literacy was in the single digits. It was magical. It was a religion and blah, blah, blah. You know, you wear a funny hat on top. We're going into a world where it is trivially easy to tokenize and issue any economic interest in anything that you do that can float on markets immediately and that has no distinction between equity or payment or a loan or any of that. And in fact, I can do it 100 times a day. So how does a traditional, let's say, value system like a Wells Fargo or a Bank of America, how does it react, or an SEC or a Federal Reserve, how does it react to 100 million teenagers issuing 20 tokens a day for the rest of their lives that are all floating and traded in real time? I mean,
it's impossible.
And if a token is like a website or like an email, there's billions of websites, there's billions of YouTube videos, you know, like it's like when waiting for permission to make a movie from a film studio versus the endless YouTube clips out there of people just accruing content into the void of the internet. You know, and I think that's where we are with what finance and economics means. And so it's a very hard thing to restructure the past to accommodate that future.
Wow. That's one of the coolest kind of explanations I've heard, especially like the fact that, or the analogy that you kind of brought to mind about how, you know, the banks and the incumbents and stuff are akin to the priests of the early, you know, humanity, when they were the only ones that knew how to write. They could control the narrative. They can control what people can do and can kind of like understand and all that kind of stuff. And now we have like, you know, blockchain and crypto, which blows the doors open off. It's like the equivalent of the printing press, right? Now everybody could learn to read, and everybody could become literate. And it's the same exact thing that's happening. And it's kind of an analogy I never really thought of. So I appreciate you bringing that to mind. Today, many small business owners are busier than ever. I mean, time spent searching for and interviewing candidates can take time away from managing and growing a business. And that's why LinkedIn Jobs has made it easier to get the candidates worth interviewing faster. And it's free. In fact, I mean, here at Crypto 101, we used LinkedIn to hire our newest employee, Ryan. And funny enough, he actually in turn worked with the folks at LinkedIn to partner with us here on the podcast as a sponsor. So how about that? You can create a job post in minutes on LinkedIn Jobs to reach your network and beyond to the world's largest professional network of over 770 million people. You can focus on candidates with the skills and experience you need. And you could use screening questions to get your role in front of only the most qualified people, and then just use the simple tools on LinkedIn Jobs to quickly filter and prioritize who you would like to interview and hire. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus leading competitors. So LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates worth interviewing faster. Did you know that every week, actually, nearly 40 million job seekers visit LinkedIn? So post your job for free at linkedin.com/crypto. That's linkedin.com/crypto to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Many of you guys have probably heard about how the market for collectibles, including NFTs, have gone totally crazy over the last year. And the problem, though, is that even if you wanted to invest in some of these assets, the price tags are simply out of reach for most investors. But there's actually solutions to this problem, and I want to tell you about one of those right now. So this podcast is actually sponsored by Otis. So Otis is actually an investment platform that makes it possible for almost anyone to invest in shares of cultural assets. So here's how it works. You download their app and you sign up for free. Then they've got over 100 items available for you to invest in, from rare collectibles like sports cards and comics and video games to NFTs and contemporary art and even rare sneakers for all you sneakerheads out there. And shares usually start around 10 bucks. Plus, they add new assets every week. And then thirdly, you can actually earn a potential return if Otis sells the underlying asset for more than the price the item was dropped at, or by selling your shares to other Otis members on Otis's real-time trading platform. So there's art, sports cards, video games, and so much more. And I love music. And I actually just saw on the site actually a boxed first-generation iPod, which is now 20 years old, which is pretty cool. So right now, Otis is actually offering listeners of this show a free share. How about that? When they fund their account, pretty cool. So all you have to do, go to www.withotis.com/crypto101 and sign up for your first share for free. So that is with Otis, which is withotis.com/crypto101. And guys, terms and conditions do apply. So the cost of living is rising, right? That's pretty much apparent. I mean, what else is new? Buying a home, renting an apartment, your gas, your groceries, and basically most, if not all of, you know, life's necessities, they get more and more expensive over time. And all of this comes while not wanting to leave loved ones with huge financial burdens as well. And on that note, it actually makes sense why people do get life insurance, especially term coverage, which is surprisingly affordable. So why not pay a bit each month to protect the ones you love? And if you're asking yourself this question, you got to choose Ladder. Ladder is 100% digital. No doctors, no needles, no paperwork when you apply for $3 million in coverage or less, okay? You need just a few minutes and a phone or a laptop to apply. Ladder's smart algorithms work in real time, so you'll find out instantly if you're approved. And if you do prefer to talk to a person, their team of licensed agents doesn't work on commission. So they'll help you and not upsell you. And there's also no hidden fees. You could cancel at any time. And you could also get a full refund if you change your mind within that first 30 days. And Ladder policies are issued by insurers with long proven histories of paying claims. They're rated A and A+. By AM Best. Okay. Finally, since life insurance costs more as you age, I mean, really, if you think about it, now's the time to cross that off your list. So go to ladderlife.com/crypto101 today to see if you're instantly approved. That's LADDER life.com/crypto101, ladderlife.com/crypto101.
You know, with MetaMask, we often talk about self-sovereignty, and it's tough because often you go down this rabbit hole and you kind of self-radicalize, you know, and crypto people can start to, they can start to sound pretty nuts in terms of the claims that you make about how society works and about how, what your the types of promises that you make about the world and so on. But it is awesome to be in this moment because these things are really possible, at least to think about. And even if they don't happen exactly that way, even if the downside is just, oh, you know, Visa is a $500 billion card network, that's our downside, you know, why not aim for the big thing and be curious? And I think that's the opportunity that everybody in the space has today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned earlier, you know, people are making tokens left and right. It can be a very confusing space, even for people that are constantly locked in. When you're looking at a token or tokenomics of a project, what are some features that you're looking for to stand out that make you say, yes, this is a good thing to support or invest in? Not investment advice, of course, but what makes a token better than another, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask. From your vantage point.
I like all your questions are dangerous. It's good.
We like to live on the edge.
Yeah. So this really depends on what you're analyzing or what it is that you're talking about. So I think that it's sometimes easier to tell when a project is bad than it is when a project is good.
Let's go there in that direction then. What are some red flags that you would suggest every listener avoid falling into?
Yeah. So if you're getting if you're getting a vibe from your counterparty that says that they're trying to get you to do something, right? And I think we all know when we get the spam email that it's a spam email. If you're getting that vibe from somebody or you're getting a sense that this project is being really aggressively marketed or that there's some other incentive going on, I think follow your guts and avoid the red flag. At the same time, you can be a little bit proactive, right? You can create a thesis on a space. You can have a fundamental view about how the world's going to evolve. And so I think these days we've got like the computational blockchains that process a lot of transactions and run a lot of software. You know, and I think there are themes around, is this project scaling a core computational network? Is it adding to it in some way? And these are called layer two projects for, you know, for scalability, like Polygon or what's Optimistic Ethereum or Arbitrum, things of that nature. And then there are adjacent kind of tooling for what people are now calling the metaverse, which is the types of software that you can run on a blockchain that also plug into social experiences that are, they're often rendered digitally, right? So rendered in 3D or on Twitter or through NFTs or whatever. And so that requires file storage, you know, so things like Filecoin or Arweave. And then it also requires identity solutions. And so you can start to kind of piece together an idea of how the world's going to be. And if projects fit that fundamental thesis, you know, often that's quite helpful.
Yeah, fascinating. And are there, again, like when we talk about, those are the red flags. Now, what are some of the green check marks that you look at? And again, you know, scaling core computational networks, all that kind of stuff is awesome. But is there like, do you look at the people behind the projects? Do you think like, oh, you know, if they're anonymous, they're going to be better or worse? Or, you know, these people really should have like, you know, an executive sort of history of doing, you know, if it's a supply chain management coin or whatever, they should be you know, a big group of guys that have been, you know, Fortune 500 executives. Do you kind of give any credence to the people behind projects like that?
case by case, you know, so in enterprise projects, which are not likely to be decentralized, but might connect into various industries, you know, so Figure with Mike Cagney, who's a former SoFi founder, I think is the best example of an enterprise project with a lot of on the ground traction. And then you've got R3 and a bunch of others. Of course, Consensus is involved in some of these things. If you're going to go sell to industry, then yeah, you need industry experience, but these don't tend to be things that you can buy in a decentralized way. I mean, there's a little bit of stuff like this in Centrifuge with Jason Jones doing a great job there. And then their MakerDAO just got a proposal from SocGen, a large investment bank, and their Forge unit to try and use the DeFi protocol. But broadly speaking, it's rare to find institutional people of that type who are building traditional stuff, but on DeFi rails. I think when you look at native decentralized applications, you've got to have an open mind about the type of founders that are building things. You know, SushiSwap is one of the best examples of a very funky launch with anonymous founders and even, you know, controversy and a rug pull that has ended up being one of the premier projects in the space. I mean, really fast execution, billions of value kind of accrued into the smart contracts of SushiSwap. So I think in a case of a protocol like that, it's actually really helped to be open to anyone contributing. I do think that we are much closer to like a industry set point where people don't just do anonymous projects, but they're part of some DAO, part of some decentralized autonomous organization, you know, or if we want to use just old words, they're on an internet forum and they've got enough tokens to belong to a group where they have a financial stake or a reputational stake in making sure a project does well. And so if you know, you might not be able to verify traditional social capital, like this person went to this university, you know, and or this person worked at this investment bank or at Google or Facebook or whatever. You might not have those markers, but there might be other markers of commitment, of financial commitment from that particular team member that is, you know, verified on chain through a purchase of an NFT, for example, right? So if somebody owns a CryptoPunk and that's verified, or a Baze Ape, you might have more trust in that person because they belong to a community that's more likely to remedy any trust breaches. But all this stuff is very, very high risk tolerance. So, you know, saying to be careful is almost pointless. I think you just have to take a portfolio approach where you expect some amount of wipeout in order to access some of the higher return profiles assets.
Yeah, very well said. And I think the Sushi example is a great one, how it really looked very, very dismal after, you know, 2 weeks, but the community really believed in it and turned it into really one of crypto's best unicorns, or in Sushi's case, literally a unicorn killer. When in competition with Uniswap. But speaking of killers, you know, the narrative for years has been, you know, what's the next big Ethereum killer to finally come along and become better than Ethereum, whether it's Solana or Cardano or Cardano. But I think the narrative's actually changing. This is my opinion. I want yours as well. I think these things are all going to become Ethereum helpers. And in the narrative that layer ones are going to become the new telecoms for Web3. Just as Verizon and AT&T and GTE all had to merge their systems together to talk to one another, so I believe all layer ones will eventually, and the ones that don't are simply going to die out, like a university intranet compared to the internet. What's your view from Consensus in terms of everything essentially becoming Ethereum compatible?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, just 25 years ago, the word telecom was very cool. Like, it was very cool to lay wire, you know, in the ground.
John Malone, the cable cowboy, right?
There you go. And how quickly how quickly recent innovation becomes taken for granted, and like the version of sort of like accounting and kind of lame, which is unfair. I mean, Bitcoin mining, I think, is like this, right? Like 7 years ago, Bitcoin mining was hot, and now it's like, oh, just another data center kind of. So I do think that the sort of excitement about layer one is, like you say, is going to melt a bunch of things together to create Web3. And this is in part why we as Consensus and as MetaMask have shifted our thinking, despite starting out only on Ethereum, we've shifted our thinking to being a Web3 provider, because this broader thematic is foundational at a multinational level, the way that the internet is. And it's almost impossible to tell a priori what the components of Web3 are, but we can tell what the big pieces are. And we think that Ethereum is going to continue to be the main trust settlement layer for major value. Yes, it can get extremely expensive to use Ethereum, but that is a price for what it provides. You know, and so
block space is limited, right? I mean, if block space wasn't limited and everybody could just post whatever they want on the Ethereum network, it would slow down and it'd be spammed attacks. So the fees are high, because listeners complain to us all the time, well, why is Ethereum cost $100 or $200 to transact? Well, because everybody wants to do it. It's supply and demand.
Yep. And so, I mean, but at the same time, we want to accommodate all the demand. And so the additional layers that are being attached, as well as the side chains that are being attached, you know, are getting a ton of use, and that's fantastic. And so Consensus has enabled a bunch of other networks, including Polygon, including, I'm not sure exactly what we've announced or not, but, you know, we're working with most, if not all, of the layer two scaling solutions. And in which ways? Well, it's important for people to write software to those, so they're part of the Infura API suite. You know, Filecoin, IPFS. And then from a MetaMask perspective, people need to be able to use these chains. And so Binance Smart Chain, the Polygon chain,
AVAX, CNET. Yeah,
all of this stuff. Now, where it gets a little bit crunchier is where the underlying blockchain network is not EVM compatible, Ethereum virtual machine compatible, where it has a different logic such that things don't really transfer from the Ethereum view to, you know, like the Solana view or something like that, or the Bitcoin view. And that gets a little tougher because it's more expensive for us to integrate. And sometimes the motivations of people who are launching some of these networks, you know, are questionable. We've had $4 billion year-long wash trading ICOs in 2017 that wanted to say they're an Ethereum killer while using Ethereum to raise their ICO. So we're not going to try to turn everything on, but we're going to try to turn on as much capacity and as much scale and as much functionality as we can in order for as many people as possible to onboard into Web3. You know, and if you look at Ethereum active addresses now, it's, you know, Ethereum addresses are maybe 150 million, 160. We think Web3 altogether, the way that we kind of count it, is around 350 million, give or take. You know, and lots of people have multiple addresses.
Right.
But there's another 7 billion people out there, and our goal is to reach all of them.
Fantastic. No, I love that. And one of the things I think that is going to help alleviate some of the congestion or maybe some of the high fees, I think, will be this transition to Ethereum 2.0. So Lex, can you give us, you know, the high level on Ethereum 2.0, what it's trying to accomplish? And, you know, again, not really from a technical standpoint, just from a high level.
Sure. Look, Ethereum is a trailblazer in its invention and deployment and actual production of a blockchain that can run software. There's, you know, it's not a lot of blockchains that could run software in 2016. And that's still the case today. Very few can and do it successfully and not crash and all that, or claim to have decentralization or claim to have economic value. But there have been a couple of innovations on top of the original architecture, original technical idea. And so the ETH2 upgrade, and I don't know if it's still, you know, called ETH2 or how people are thinking about it, but there's been a lot of work on getting us towards a set of upgrades that sort of comprise this next generation version, has a couple of different components. And so the first component has to do with how you agree on what the truth is. And so today, Bitcoin and Ethereum and a few other less relevant currencies, the way that they achieve the truth, you know, the consensus of the blockchain, is by proof of work, which is sort of you're providing evidence that you're spending money by burning electricity. That's the reductive way to say it. There's
That's proof of work. That's Bitcoin. That's a lot. Yes. You know, Ethereum currently.
Yes. So it's a useful engine to prove that the information on the network is true through mining and so on. And this is a first generation mechanism. It works, which is amazing in its own right. So no offense to Bitcoin or the existing miners or the existing approach. It has stood up this incredible network. But in many ways, there have been pushback about the electric consumption of this. And you know, I want to leave the conversation of whether that's accurate or not to the side and just say, you know, one of the key features of ETH2 is transitioning out of proof of work, which is the electric consumption, and towards proof of stake, which is, let's just say, financial exposure, skin in the game. So we think, and there have been a number of blockchains that have proven, that you can achieve similar qualities, meaning like stuff on this network is true, not through the burning of electricity, but through putting skin in the game, getting your assets, putting them on the line, and being punished if you cheat. And so that's kind of number one. And most next generation computational chains are using a version of these different consensus mechanisms that don't require machines in the real world. Everything requires a machine in the real world, but not necessarily a graphics card spinning endlessly to solve a puzzle. So that's number one. And then number two is, you know, how do you put more computation into Ethereum? And we've gotten a lot of independent projects that attach to Ethereum and bridge to it and are, you know, layer twos or side chains or what have you, rollups, things like that. ETH2 has a native embedded concept for sharding multiple chains. So for having lots, you can think of us having lots and lots of lanes or lots and lots of train tracks instead of just one road that are able to just absorb a lot more traffic, and not like twice as much, but an order of magnitude more traffic and computational processing, and then have clever ways using complicated mathematics to anchor it back to kind of the main chain, which proves that things are true. And so that's number two, is having a native scalability approach, you know, and that doesn't prejudice the scalability approaches that exist now. If anything, those have accelerated what Ethereum wanted to do. And it's possible that that is the solution. It's possible that we already have the solution to scalability, and it just needs to be kind of organized and made a little bit more simple. You know, and so that can be kind of a grindy, crunchy description of what to fix, but it shows you that people have been thinking about the types of stuff that users often complain about, which is like, how do you make it go faster? How do you have more of it? And how do you make it so that mining isn't as hard?
That's fascinating. I love it. Proof of stake, I think, is going to be, it's funny. I was talking to my fiance the other day and she goes, "Hey, Bryce, did the crypto guys ever figure out like the whole energy crisis thing? Like, is that solved yet?" I was like, "Oh, you've been reading too much news." But it's been solved. It's just not popularized yet or 100% kind of proliferated. But Lex, I want to switch gears a little bit to the macro. You know, you're the head economist at Consensus. So we want a little bit of your kind of thoughts and opinions on, you know, maybe Powell and the Fed stating that they have no intention of banning U.S. participation, which is a great thing, but you have, you know, other, you know, massive nations, right, that are like China that are completely banning it. And so what's your kind of thoughts on like the macro environment and kind of how it comes to bear on crypto?
Yeah, this is one of these questions where there's so many memes. And so you really have to pay attention to the narrative that you're both consuming, believing, as well as the narrative that you're saying, because often the narratives are just kind of like flag waving. And so I still think it's fun to say that and point out that China banned the internet. I mean, they banned the internet. They got a firewall, so you can't do the things. You can't do the American things on the Chinese internet. So there's no information. There's nothing to derive from the fact that China is trying to ban crypto assets. It's literally no information in that, other than they see it as dangerous as the internet to the particular social order they're trying to create, right? And so I think that's kind of number one, because on-chain public Web3 is rooted in very self-sovereign libertarian concepts, hyper-capitalist sort of property, digital property concepts as a foundation. And then what's kind of being layered on top are these communalist concepts of self-organization and unionizing. So crypto is a really interesting kind of political space, actually, because you've got Adam Smith underneath, and then you've got Marx on top. It literally is that. It's very, you know, the anarchists are also hippies. So I think there is sort of this type of narrative that can explain some of the things that China's reacting to. There's the other.
That's great. The anarchists and then become the hippies. It's perfect. It exactly speaks to the ethos.
Yes, if a bunch of teenagers are trading multi-million-dollar pictures of monkeys, like, who are you going to get mad at? You know, it's like the market that sells the monkey pictures or the teenager. Like, it's just nonsense. And so, you know, the other thing is for China, there's a geopolitical interest around the digital currency that they're launching, which makes sense. China's got fantastic fintech infrastructure. I mean, really fantastic fintech infrastructure. It is the envy of the West, what Ant Financial and Tencent have been able to do from QR payment. I mean, like, it is embarrassing in retrospect, in any comparison of the fintech infrastructure between the US and Asia, you know, like still writing checks and things like that. But they've got a national interest in launching a central bank controlled digital currency, which is fully accounted and tied to your identity and so on, which, you know, doesn't really comport with what used to be, I'll say, American values about privacy. And so now we come to the US, and I think there is an argument to make that, look, Ethereum is dollar denominated. You've got to actively refuse to acknowledge reality if you don't think it's in a massive Western interest to maintain and promote Web3 and the adoption of stablecoins. Like, those are just dollars that are being used by people all over the world. It's fantastic. Like, you want that. And I think for a variety of complicated and sometimes very sometimes for reasons that are not particularly valuable or rigorous, we have pushback from some parts of the power structure of the American government. You know, and that's motivated by different jurisdictions, you know, so the CFTC versus the SEC versus the OCC versus the different states. And so the desire to regulate crypto is derivative of the desire to have power more generally. And sometimes that is from applying rubrics and frameworks from a world that might have made sense a decade ago to a world that doesn't really make sense anymore, right? Where it is like, maybe it is true that all these things are just securities, but what if we have a billion times more securities than we had in the past? You know, you've got to have de minimis exceptions. You've got to rethink what the purposes of these things are, right? Like, because it's not just the definitions, it's the, you know, what do they represent and what does the stock market represent and so on and so forth. So while I'm very cautious and hesitant about the current state of American regulation, as I think we all should be given the actions relating to Coinbase and Uniswap and others, I feel an inevitability in regards to a Web3 economic structuring of the world. And, you know, regulation is a second order derivative on social organization and what people do, right? So people do things. That's the reality. That is what actually happens. Like, we all go and we do stuff. We go and we download Metallica songs on Napster. And then there's a set of problems that arise. And so then people start to complain and sue each other or try to create issues. Metallica sues teenagers for downloading MP3s on Napster and wins, you know, and then that you create the law. So the law is a first order derivative on actual activity that we do. And it finds all the edges where people's rights and interests bump into each other. There is no law when there are no problems. The law is about boundaries and problems. And it exists not because somebody wants you to do something that they think is right. It exists because you've hurt someone else with your activity. You know, so it's outlining the boundary between, it's mediating the damage between people. It's negotiating how hurt everybody is and then tries to find a fair way to hurt everyone equally, you know, and that we need this to run kind of a society. And then number two is, like, regulation is an agency that is designed to enforce parts of the law. And sometimes they act where they don't know what the law is. And sometimes they overextend and they could be wrong about their view. And largely by design, they're a conservative entity. They try to maintain whatever boundary was put in place, but they're not reality. I mean, they are a reflection of a reflection of what people actually want. Now, and so all of this points to the importance of political engagement. If you own crypto and you have a point of view, express that in voting, express that in calling your representatives. Like, it actually matters now for a lot of people, which is fantastic. You know, so I'm, that part of it is, I guess, in some ways almost motivating to get more involved.
Yeah, fantastic, man. And that was a wonderful place to kind of conclude this conversation. Lex, we would love to have you back on. There's so many other things that I want to talk about, but we're up against the hour. Lex, real quick, one word of wisdom for our new listeners, right? You know, this could be the very first podcast that somebody listened to about cryptocurrency. Their mind is blown. From an industry vet, one word of wisdom.
Curiosity. And you can choose curiosity or you can choose the opposite of curiosity. It really is up to you if you want to be a skeptic or, you know, Debbie Downer. Like, you can choose that view, or you can choose to be curious, and the curiosity will unlock all the rest of the stuff. So go grab a MetaMask wallet and fuss around and have fun.
Love it. Love it. I love that. Lex, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. And we hope to speak with you again soon.
My pleasure.